In the coming week, Mexico holds pivotal midterm elections. Hong Kongers try to mark the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre, and Peruvians vote in a divisive presidential runoff. It's June 3rd, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Shannon O'Neill, sitting in for Jim Lindsay.
Well, listeners to the podcast will know Shannon's voice. She is the Vice President, Deputy Director of Studies, and Nelson and David Rockefeller Senior Fellow for Latin American Studies at CFR. Shannon, as always, a pleasure to have you back on The World Next Week.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Bob.
Well, we're starting in a country you know sort of well. That would be Mexico. This weekend, Mexicans will be voting in what's being called the largest election in the country's history. They will choose candidates for over 21,000 offices. This election marks the halfway point in President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's term. He's also known as AMLO. And this is widely referred to as a potential referendum on his first 3 years in office. Shannon, can you give us a little bit more of a sense of what's at stake in these elections?
This is, in many ways, a referendum on his last 2.5 years as president. And so AMLO, he's fondly known as AMLO by many. He came in on this wave, a landslide, where he took both the presidency, but also both houses of Congress. He had a majority in both. And he has a big political ambition to remake Mexico. In fact, he has a name for it. He calls it the Fourth Transformation. And it is all about changing the economy, making Mexico more inclusive, expanding social programs, and really changing the social, economic, and political dimensions of Mexico. It's also been about concentrating power within the executive, and particularly with his political party. So this is, in many ways, a referendum on what he's done and what he hopes to do. Interestingly, he personally has remained very popular, even though Mexico has been one of the hardest hit countries in the world with COVID. It has seen the economy decline almost 8% last year and has the slow recovery right now. It has seen violence continue unabated. So lots of the things that he promised to solve have not been solved. We've seen poverty increase rather than decrease. Lots of these problems are there, but he personally has remained very popular. And what these elections are questioning is his party as popular as he is? As he personally is not on the ballot. This is about the members of Congress, the lower house of Congress. It's about 15 governors. It's about thousands of local, municipal, and state level elections. So this is the big question. And what Mexico watchers are looking for is how strong his party will come out. He hopes that they will get a constitutional majority in the House and Senate with his party, as well as some of the parties that vote with his party. And then they could make big changes to the Constitution. They could change the energy sector, where he'd like to bring it back to the government. He could change other parts of the Constitution that he and his party disagree with. Most of the polls seem to say that he won't get that. He will get a majority with these satellite parties or parties that vote with him, but not this big constitutional majority. So that's really what people are watching. And that will set the tone and really the path for him and his government for the final 3 years of Mexico's what they call the sexenio, a six-year term that they allow their presidents.
I'm wondering about turnout because of several things. One, you mentioned the question of violence. I saw the front page of today's Washington Post calling these some of the most violent elections in Mexico's history. But also, we saw the lingering COVID. Are we going to have an election that's sort of overshadowed by those issues and maybe a turnout will be lower?
You know, it's hard to know. It is true. We've seen rising levels of violence directed at candidates, actually. And so here, especially on the local level, whether it's organized criminal groups that operate in those levels or others that are trying to come in, threatening or worse for many candidates that aren't controlled by these local gangs. And so you are seeing a bit of that come into the elections in that sense. And then there's also, you know, there are some strong arm tactics by the political parties, by others trying to shape these elections at the local level. You know, like our country here in the United States, a lot of times, you know, the local popularity of politicians doesn't have a lot to do with what's going on at the national level. It has to do with issues that are happening in a city or in the state. So a lot of people are turning out because of those very issues. And, you know, Mexicans are frustrated with the way their politics and their economics and their health systems have worked over the last, you know, year. So they have a lot to go to the ballot box for. But as you say, disease, poverty, violence, those things also, you know, may keep people from the apathy, among some at least, has been growing.
Shannon, as you know, a lot of Americans look at Mexico and they think of two issues right off the bat, the border and migrants. Any sense those issues have any bearing in these elections? I note that Kamala Harris will be in the country in the next couple of days talking about those issues.
know, these are less important for these internal elections, I would say. Though, you know, one thing that has happened, we talk a lot about the migrants that are at our U.S. border, but Mexico has absorbed tens of thousands of Central Americans too. So in some municipalities, in some cities and the like, many people are struggling with some of the issues we struggle with here. You know, migrants are coming and they're worried they're taking their jobs, or they're worried about, you know, integrating them unevenly into the society and the economies, the local economy. So some of those tensions do exist in Mexico. They're having their own, you know, moment of dealing with that in a political sense as well as in other senses. But really what's on the agenda for many Mexicans are the issues that have been there that brought López Obrador to power 3 years ago in the election, but are still there. So the challenges of insecurity and violence, that's front and center. And on all these polls, Mexicans care about that. They want themselves and their families to be safe, and they don't feel that in many parts of the country. Mexicans care about corruption and that side of things. Mexicans care about the economy, about their jobs, or, you know, their family members, how unstable or stable that they may be, what the opportunities may be going forward. So a lot of those bread and butter issues that we think about in our own elections that bring in politicians, that's really what it looks like Mexicans will be voting on as they come to the polls on Sunday.
And I would think most Americans would also care quite a bit that Mexico goes in the path of proper governance, because there's all sorts of interrelated issues that the two countries share.
You know, one of the questions that people who are watching this and people are worrying about is, as here in the United States, we have some, including our former president, who refused to go with the results of the previous election, there's worries that, you know, López Obrador, AMLO, if he doesn't win as many seats as he had thought or as many governorships as he thought, that he too may claim fraud, that he may not, you know, go with, there's a very respected and independent National Electoral Institute that already members of his party have been attacking, sort of leading up to this idea that perhaps the elections won't be fair. I don't see that being the problem at the ballot so much. I mean, there's lots of issues about, you know, gray campaign financing and these sorts of things that happen in many countries around the world, including Mexico. But that is something that I will be watching come Monday, as does the president accept the results of the elections, particularly if they don't go as well for his party. And all of this, as you were saying, Kamala Harris is headed down there next week. You know, she will be going down to talk about migration, to talk about the border, to talk about lots of issues. And she'll be going into a country that may have, you know, sort of the lingering tensions of this recent election. So we'll see how that all goes, and then where the U.S. fits in with that.
So yet again, another test for democracy on the horizon.
Yes, indeed. And one right next door in our neighbor. And speaking of tests for democracy, or perhaps failed tests of democracy, Bob, let's turn to another quite sobering anniversary that comes up this week. So tomorrow, on June 4th, this is the 32nd anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. And so for the second year in Hong Kong, the police have cited coronavirus restrictions to ban any vigils to remember the Communist Party's crackdown on this pro-democracy movement that happened in 1989 in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. We do expect Hong Kong activists, despite this ban, will turn out to recognize and to remember this June 4th anniversary. They'll probably be in smaller groups than the larger groups that we have seen in the past. But Bob, why don't you tell us a little bit about this anniversary and what you're expecting?
Shannon, this anniversary has typically been, up to last year, probably the world's most significant commemoration of Tiananmen Square massacre. This is the June 4th, 1989 event in which hundreds, possibly as many as thousands, we still don't know, people were killed in a brutal crackdown by the Beijing government to end what had been this extraordinary series of demonstrations across China, really, that were an exercise in calling for greater freedoms and greater democratic freedoms. Remember, 1989 was this breathtaking year where you had ultimately the fall of the Berlin Wall and sweeping democratic movements coming into Eastern Europe. 2 years later, you had the collapse of the Soviet Union. So that was a period of time where that kind of gust of democracy was felt strongly. And China had its own episode and then its own brutal crackdown. And the government followed up by repressing, certainly on the mainland, any sort of discussion of it by basically doing a blackout on any kind of reference to Tiananmen Square. But they had allowed, even after the handover of Hong Kong to China in 1997, they had allowed these commemorations to take place in Hong Kong. So you had the only large-scale commemoration for more than 20 years of the Tiananmen Square massacre on Chinese soil taking place in Hong Kong. As we've seen again and again in recent years, though, they are tightening the vice on any sort of expressions of freedom, especially anything that challenges the Communist Party orthodoxy on the mainland. And so this year is going to be a really big test, as a number of pro-democracy activists have already been thrown into jail for taking part in last year's Sanders kind of mini vigil that some took part in. We've now had, after the authorities not allowing a vigil this year, we've had the Hong Kong Security Bureau saying anyone participating in an unauthorized assembly could be jailed for up to 5 years. Those who publicize an event could face an additional 12-month sentence. We know they mean business because the new national security law has been used as a pretense for all sorts of things that had been never seen before in Hong Kong. Real clampdown on media, clampdown on museum exhibits, student events, on and on and on. It's going to be looked very closely this year at what sort of ability Hong Kongers will have to gather in any capacity or to commemorate in any capacity Tiananmen Square. One interesting venue will be churches. There are a number of churches that are planning to mark the event. So as you said at the outset, Shannon, it's another sort of test for waning democracy in Hong Kong.
How do you see other governments around the world reacting? Because obviously it's been a very difficult subject with Hong Kong and the changes in administration, the crackdown generally on the protests there. Do you see the United States or European countries or any others stepping in this moment and in this commemoration of this anniversary? Or is just there's too many economic or other interests on the table?
It's a really good question. I think you will see the Biden administration, as we did see with the Trump administration, taking note of the narrowing path for democracy in Hong Kong and really holding the communist authorities to task for it. But also, we're likely to see a real strong sort of backlash from Chinese officials in any sort of messaging coming out of the U.S. or Europe, for that matter, on what they regard as China's internal affairs. In the U.S. case, you've already seen in various ways how the Chinese officials try to turn this on its end and point back to the U.S. saying, hey, you have your own problems with Black Lives Matter protests and with the attack on the Capitol. Who are you to point the finger at us? That kind of thing. But also, Europe is an interesting case because you have an increasing number of European countries that have been in favor of doing business with China, but then also this rising debate in Europe about, you know, the limits of that and the importance of speaking out for human rights and democratic freedoms. That kind of reaction is going to be very interesting to see, first of all, in any sort of official statements that come out about the anniversary from Europe or the United States, but also in the event there is any sort of attempt to hold a vigil or commemoration in Hong Kong, if there's a further crackdown, you could see some pretty strong statements coming out, at least from the U.S. I've seen some reports saying that there going to be something like 3,000 anti-riot officers on reserve in case there's an unauthorized gathering. So Chinese authorities, Hong Kong authorities doing their bidding are bracing for and seem to be ready for a pretty harsh crackdown.
Yeah, I noted yesterday, I believe, the Chinese, in other areas of disputes, and particularly with the Uyghurs, not only have they gone after H&M, so a European company, they're now going after Nike. And so any of those apparels will be marked with a tag that says that they're you know, sort of anathema to the regime. So, the boycotts, the pushing back against any of these sort of Western values or democratic values is something that they seem very ready and willing to do.
Absolutely. I mean, we're really seeing a new strain and a new kind of vigor in the pushback from Chinese authorities on these issues. But Shannon, I'm going to keep alive the theme we have developed in this podcast of tenuous democratic exercises. And let's go to Peru. Peruvians are heading to the polls to vote in a presidential runoff election this weekend. There are two candidates who couldn't be more far apart, seemingly, on the issues. You have a right-wing candidate, Keiko Fujimori. The last name sounds familiar to some. And the country's socialist candidate, Pedro Castillo. And they've been, according to the latest opinion polls, seem to be neck and neck. Shannon, give us a sense. What should we know about these elections before Peruvians head to the polls?
Well, these are difficult elections. Let's start there. In the first round of the election, there were a number of candidates running, and no one got more than 15%. So it really is an incredibly fragmented pool of candidates. And interestingly, Pedro Castillo, who got the most votes, which is 15%, he was so unknown by those outside of the country that when CNN was doing its tallies, they didn't even have a picture of him. They just had a shadow because no one had a picture of him, even though he became the front runner in these elections. So that tells you a little bit about the anti-incumbent sort of, you know, anti-establishment feel of the Peruvian voters. Very fragmented and very skeptical of the political establishment in that country. So you see, as you were saying, you see a very different, you have someone from the right and someone with a long legacy of corruption, frankly, and sort of dirty dealings in Congress. Her father in particular is in jail for corruption and crimes against humanity and all sorts of things. She too has been in jail on charges of bribery and the like from the time when she was in the Congress in Peru. So you have, a long history as a politician and a pretty sordid one from the one candidate. And then you have Pedro Castillo, who comes from, nowhere in the political establishment. He's a rural activist and part of the teachers union, support from there, and has very kind of old school leftist and even Marxist views about where the economy should go and the like. Though it's very unclear, as he's been out campaigning between these two rounds and the the lead up to the final round of the election, it's really unclear where his positions are, or if he's really thought through those sorts of things. So it's a very stark choice, and both of them are pretty difficult candidates for those of us who care about democratic governance and checks and balances and pragmatic approaches to government and all those kinds of things that, you know, policy wonks like us care about in the world, in our own country and in the world. So it looks to be a bit of a rough ride for Peru going forward, I would say.
In the case of Castillo, is it in any way analogous to some of the kind of leftist movements, Bolivarian movements and so forth we've seen emerge in Bolivia and Ecuador recently? Or is this just really unique to Peru, where he's coming from and what he's promising to do?
There are some parallels, definitely. And I think especially the business community in Peru is quite worried about that. There are big differences as well. So one of the biggest differences, I would say, is the fragmentation of the Peruvian political system. Either of them, when they win, will have a very small part of the Congress that is their political party representative. So they'll have very few votes in the Congress. So it'll be very hard to push things through. And Castillo is such an outsider that he doesn't know how those levers of power work. You know, Keiko Fujimori has been there enough times that even though she has a small number of members of her party in the Congress, she does know how to pull those levers of party and sort of bring together coalitions, often, you know, I think with illicit means, but to sort of get people together to vote for things. And that is something that Castillo has never done and never been part of. So I think one of the biggest challenges for both of them is, yes, Castillo might come in with a very leftist agenda. And so, you know, for big mining companies or others that are down there, you know, be a bit unsettling, let's say. And he's talked about that he would like to renegotiate and or even just have international mining companies and others leave Peru. But I think there'll be a real challenge about whether he can do anything given the challenges in working with the Congress and frankly, whether he will make it through the term. He isn't even elected yet. And there's a question about whether he'll make it through his term. And, you know, the past two or three presidents in Peru have not made it through their term. And so, and they, many of them had, you know, stronger ties, more political experience, and, you know, a bit more savvy about these things. So I think there's a real question about the stability of Peru's democracy in terms of, you know, regular shifts of power in the various branches through elections. So we will have to see what happens. I think Keiko Fujimori has a better chance of hanging in there, you know, but through ways that are really unfortunate for the democratic institutions, for transparency, for those who care about reforming Peru's system and making it, you know, a more effective government for Peruvians who have had a terrible year in terms of COVID. It's one of the countries with the highest numbers of per capita deaths, just overwhelmed healthcare systems, the economy flailing as well. And, you know, Peruvians need good government right now. Everyone needs good government, but particularly this is a country that needs good government. And I don't see either of these candidates providing it for that nation.
Yeah, I think the note of worry is the one that's kind of residing with everyone right now. I'm thinking about, again, I don't know if it's a too broad comparison, but before Brazil's elections a few years ago, this extreme sort of concern about corruption there. And corruption obviously is this prevailing issue in Peru. But in Brazil, it brought in Jair Bolsonaro, and that led to a whole other cascade of issues that people are still kind of sorting out. But there's a lot of concern about Brazil. Do you see the corruption issue as carrying one of these two candidates further than the other, or are they both, it's kind of a wash?
You know, interesting, it's the Brazilian corruption issue has played a part in bringing down Peru's political establishment. So Alan Garcia, who's a former president, was implicated in the Lava Jato and other corruption scandals that went from Brazil. That was the car wash scandal that started with Brazilian politicians and business leaders and the like, and one of their biggest construction companies. And that seeped into other countries because that was, Odebrecht was a construction company that worked throughout the region and seems bribed politicians all across the region, including the, you know, allegedly the former president of Peru, Alan Garcia, who committed suicide rather than face the charges. And so that helped disintegrate some of these parties. And so it opened the space for outsiders like Pedro Castillo to gain traction. You know, interestingly, especially the Fujimoris have such a track record of corruption and sort of dirty dealings. And at least so far in the campaign, in the second round, Castillo hasn't capitalized on that as much as one would have thought. And I think that attests more to his outsider status, the fact that he really isn't a career politician, that he doesn't have a team that's professionalized around him. And you know, that I think bodes for more uncertainty if he does come out on top, and we will just see on Sunday. It's hard to tell right now. You know, back to your question about Mexico, who's going to turn out to vote? Is it you're going to see a big turnout in the rural areas, or is it going to be mostly in the urban areas, and how does that work? But if he does come out on top, I would expect him to be less effective in the government. Not necessarily less corrupt. I think actually Fujimori will see an increase in corruption if she does come out on top. top because she already has those networks and she's known for it. But neither of them do I see a cleaning up of the system or pushing it forward in the kinds of directions that we all would hope.
It's just a grim prognosis all the way around these days, Shannon.
It is a grim prognosis. And, you know, on that, let's turn to another place that has elections. And it's time to pivot. And let's talk about our audience figure of the week. And this is a figure where listeners can vote on or they can tweet at us at CFR_org. And so this week, Bob, our audience has selected Naftali Bennett. So why don't you tell us a little bit about him and how he factors into this all election world next week?
Sure, Shannon. So we're recording this on an early Thursday afternoon, and here's where things stand right now. A great choice by our audience because Bennett is a man of the moment or one of the people of the moment in Israel right now. Israel, as we've discussed on this podcast before, has notoriously complex elections and incredibly difficult to parse out alliances and coalitions and so forth. Bennett seems to have pulled off, and again, it still needs to be sorted out and ultimately approved by the Israeli parliament, but he seems to have pulled off an incredibly difficult maneuver in getting an extremely diverse group of parties to stitch together a coalition to oust Benjamin Netanyahu, who's been in the leadership of Israel for 12 years now. And it seems to be all about Netanyahu and about toxic sort of circumstances surrounding him that have brought people like Bennett, who is a former chief of staff to Netanyahu, former cabinet minister in his governments in the past, but has basically said enough is enough. And he's made common cause with a cross-section of people, including a centrist, Yair Lapid, who would, under the arrangement, take over as prime minister 2 years after Bennett serves. Now, Bennett himself has been a champion of the settlers in the West Bank, has even gone so far as to say he would annex the West Bank and seen as an ultra-nationalist. But he has, under the agreements hammered out, seems to be an issue that would be muted, in part because he's also looped into the coalition arrangement an Arab party for the first time, Arab, or as they refer to themselves, Israeli Palestinians. But there's a party that has also decided to join in. Now, Bennett's party as Yamina won just 7 of the 120 seats in parliament. But again, with Lapid's movement, with some leftist parties, with the Israeli-Palestinian movements and so forth, they will have just enough, it looks like 61 seats under their control to run the country. The idea is that with Netanyahu leaving the scene, Israelis can start to make common cause and with a kind of a tenuous balancing act, move the country forward in ways that were seen as stymied by Netanyahu's own kind of orchestration of politics and demonizing of enemies and so forth. So it remains to be seen. Within the next 10 days or so, there will have to be a parliament vote. There's a great deal of lobbying going on still that could end up pulling off one candidate or another. It just takes one or two and the whole thing comes down. So we'll have to see what happens. But at the moment now, and as our audience has decided to highlight, 49-year-old Naftali Bennett seems to be in a commanding position to nudge out Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time in 12 years.
So what will this mean for the Biden administration? Does it make it easier or harder for them to deal with Israel if they can pull this off?
It's a great question. There's a lot of kind of spot analysis at the moment saying on balance, it could make it easier since because of the, let's say, the diversity of this coalition in Israel, they will push aside some of the fractious issues and basically punt down the road anything like ramping up West Bank settlements or trying to annex the West Bank for that matter. And in so doing, that becomes a bit easier to manage for the Biden administration, which would rather not be dealing with thorny Israeli politics, but also a resurgence of fighting with the Palestinians. We've just come through this period, ceasefire still holding between Hamas and the Israeli government after the worst outbreak in violence in 7 years, part of which started over back and forth escalation of fighting in Jerusalem and around the holy areas. So all in all, you could have a coalition that is actually taking a more moderate stance on some of the fractious issues, despite Bennett's own preference on settlement issues. You could have a moderation going on that will sort of calm things. And that means for the Biden administration, maybe a chance to start, you know, building up on a sort of behind the scenes way, the relationship with Israel and not get into some of the more difficult issues involved in that relationship. You still have all sorts of other issues playing out. I think the U.S. is due to approve a military aid agreement relatively soon to Israel and other things like that that will play out. But at the same time, you could have an Israeli government that might be reaching out more to U.S. Democrats and not solely to Republicans, which is what Netanyahu was seen to have done in the last several years of his leadership.
Well, it'll be interesting because the Biden administration has talked about stepping back a bit from the Middle East and having less of a footprint there. So we'll see if this brings them back in more or if it gives them that space to do so.
Yeah, nobody will be looking more keenly to the events next 10 days than the Biden administration.
Well, Bob, that seems our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories that we should all keep an eye on. One is the G7 finance ministers will be meeting in person in London. A constitutional referendum is taking place in the Gambia, and Arab foreign ministers are set to meet in Qatar.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed on The World Next Week are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program is produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also doubled as our recording engineer. Thanks, Zoe. Also, special thanks to Chloe Mauvais for her assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons.
This is Shannon O'Neill saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long. And thanks a lot, Shannon, for joining the show.
Always my pleasure.